MTV's official Challenge podcast is back for another season.
And so are we.
I'm Tori Deal.
And I'm Anissa Ferreira.
The wait is over, guys. All Stars 4 is finally here.
And this season takes it to a whole new level. Old school legends, modern power players, and ex-lovers are all competing in Cape Town, South Africa for the prize of $300,000.
And we're going to be right here along with you fans, covering every episode on the podcast.
Listen to MTV's official Challenge podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
If you love sports and true crime, then there's a new podcast from executive producer Dan Patrick and hosted by me, Jay Harris, that you won't want to miss. Playing Dirty Sports Scandals. Each week, I'm squeezing the juiciest details from some of the biggest sports scandals ever. I'm talking Marcus Dixon, Olympic gymnastics, Cain Velasquez, salacious Super Bowl-level scandals. Join me on the dark side of sports by listening to Playing Dirty Sports Scandals on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
What's up, everybody? This is Stephen A. Smith, host of the Stephen A. Smith Show podcast. Tune in every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday at the very least as I bring you all new episodes that feature the biggest headlines in the world of sports, pop culture, business, and I answer your phone calls and respond to your tweets. You'll hear my unfiltered opinions and straight-shooter interviews with top celebrities and game changers, all that and more. So listen to the Stephen A. Smith Show podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome, everyone, to the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast. I'm your host, Jimmy Traina. Thanks so much for listening. First podcast of 2021. If you missed it at the end of 2020, did a two-part year-end roundtable with Peter Schrager from Good Morning Football and Andrew Perloff from The Dan Patrick Show, where we covered the year in sports, media, and pop culture. They were two parts, the last 2 weeks of 2020. So dip into the archives and check those out if you have not listened to them. The feedback on those episodes that I've gotten on Twitter has been tremendous. People seem to really enjoy it. So if you haven't listened, check that out and hit me up on Twitter. Let me know what you think. Like I said, a lot of people have told me they really enjoyed what we did there. So hopefully you check it out. This week, we've got two guests, Andrew Marchand from the New York Post, SI Media Podcast regular, to talk about the latest sports media news. And then Armin Kentayan, who is a producer, executive producer on the upcoming Tiger Woods documentary, two-part docuseries that airs on HBO beginning this Sunday, joins me to talk about the show. A lot of spoilers there, so be careful listening. You might want to just listen to Andrew. If you don't mind spoilers, you know, I mean, listen, it's a documentary. You know what really happened in Tiger's life, but we do get in depth on the documentary. So Armin will be on after Andrew. So that is it for this episode. Let's get to it right now with our SI Media Podcast regular, Andrew Marchand. All right. Joining me now, SI Media Podcast regular from the New York Post, sports media reporter, columnist, opinionist, Andrew Marchand. Andrew, Happy New Year. How are you?
I'm good. How you doing, Jimmy?
I'm good. And let me just say, the podcast, I don't talk about it much on the pod, but we're now on YouTube. And if people keep seeing me looking up, it's because I'm watching the disgrace that is this country and the vote of the electoral votes. And I'm watching that piece of garbage Ted Cruz right now. So if you see me looking up, that's why. But I'm going to try to look at Andrew. And let's start with something very important. I just tweeted about this. Can you get the New York Post headline writers to not call Tommy John a Yankee icon in a headline?
Yeah, I saw that.
It's like, you know, it's not, it's like Ruth, Gehrig, DiMaggio, Jeter, Berra, Rivera, Tommy John. I mean, come on. I had to bust your balls about that just to start.
Yeah, well, I do think that probably wasn't a sports story. I don't think we would have called him an icon. I think you could call in sports, we probably wouldn't have. I'm not sure about that. I can't confirm that. But
just pass the message along. Yeah.
That'd be my guess. The last thing, I did see somebody, I think maybe it was David Trattner, used to work for the Jets. I think he did mention that Tommy John's surgery is iconic.
Right. But he's not an iconic Yankee. That's the point. But let's not bore the people. I just had to get that off my, I figured I have a connection here to the Post, so let me, you know.
Gotcha.
Feel like there was some
email, company-wide email.
I feel like there was a lot of good sports media news stories to sort of sink our teeth into from over the last couple of weeks during the holidays. The one that happened, I guess, weeks ago that I still am shocked by. I mean, I'm not shocked when you hear the details, but Rinaldi leaving ESPN for Fox, I think is, listen, it takes a lot for me to be like, well, that's a big one and this is significant. I thought that was significant. And he's starting right out of the gate. He's going to be on their coverage this weekend at Fox with the NFL wildcard, right?
He will be. He'll be with Joe Buck and Troy Aikman. Your boy, Aaron Andrews. Her name has escaped me for a minute for some reason. So he'll be on the A team. He did get a little bit more money, but I think anybody who makes it just about like financials, I think is wrong. I think the opportunity that he's getting is significant. I mean, he's going to be able to work a Super Bowl, World Cup, World Series. Those are things he could not do at ESPN. And I do think, you know, I talked to him, what he said about, you know, like next and a new challenge. I think that's one thing. And I also think, and he didn't say this at all, but I do think morale overall is a little bit low at ESPN. I mean, you lay off 200 to 500 people every 2 years, people start looking around, and especially even with the top talent, they're not looking to get raises. If anything, they're getting cut. So I think you factor all those things. ESPN still, in some regards, a very good place to work, but in others, there's, you know, the ground's a little shaky. And so a lot of times when that happens, people leave.
But don't you think if ESPN would have offered him the same money, he would have stayed?
I'm not sure he would have. I mean, again, I covered baseball for a long time. And, you know, when I hear it's not about the money, if you take less money, then it's not about the money. If you take the most money, it's about the money. So I can't answer that. But I do think when you look at it, you know, the money, I believe, was better. But I also think if you look at the opportunity he's getting there and where he'll be on their pecking order, it's a pretty good job. And people like working for Fox.
Do you think this is a bigger loss for ESPN or bigger, what's the word I'm looking for, positive for Fox?
I think bigger positive for Fox. I mean, I think ESPN, and this was a big talking point they had, and I think it's true, though. They do have other people, Marty Smith, who, you know, a bunch of other people who can make a difference and who can tell these stories well. And so I do think they have a deep bench still to replace Rinaldi. And but for Fox, I do think their storytelling becomes increased. And I think there's an opportunity, especially if you look at like Big Noon. You know, you move Rinaldi from ESPN on those Sunday mornings to Fox. It just may be another reason to turn that channel. And, you know, if it's something you enjoy.
Saturday mornings, just for
Saturday. Sorry.
No, that's all right. You know, the Big Noon thing is interesting because they had a great first year. And then I think this year, because of COVID and cancellations and all that, it was kind of a mess for them. And now if Urban Meyer leaves that gig for a NFL head coaching job, how much do you think that hurts that show?
Yeah, it hurts him big time. I mean, he's done a really good job of establishing himself. You know, when he came in, there are people kind of who are criticizing the choice of Urban Meyer. He wasn't great on ESPN, but he's been excellent. They've used him really well. And so I don't know, you know, everyone's replaceable. I'm not sure though, the marquee that he brings and as good as he was in terms of telling you what's going on in locker rooms and describing plays and formations and really, and being willing to say things, I think that's hard to replace.
Yeah. Switching gears, I thought it was interesting when Nance had to skip an NFL week to do golf. Romo got the week off because they didn't want to put Romo with someone else. And then when Romo couldn't do the game last week, Cardinals and Seahawks, because of COVID, they put Boomer in there with Nance. Thought that was, I mean, if you want to be into like conspiracies and stuff like that, I thought that was interesting.
Yeah. Two things I would say. Number one, the circumstances were totally different.
Like, right.
You know, so it's the last week of the season. You're not going to take Jim Nance off of like a broadcast because Tony couldn't do it. Tony was already in LA. So it was like a last second thing. So in terms of doing alternatives, CBS really didn't have time to do that. I mean,
yeah.
I guess they could have, but it wasn't a playoff game. I hear what you're saying, and I love how you're trying to stir it up. But I think it's two
just
different
just an observation.
I
thought Boomer was very, very good doing that game. Boomer could be a number one analyst for network right now.
I tweeted this. I think something that's undervalued by networks is experience. I mean, Boomer's done a million games. Like, it's not, he and Al didn't get along back in the day, but he did a Super Bowl at off the field. And then he goes into radio, which I think also helps because you learn to say things, right? You're on the air for 4 hours every morning. You learn to say things. So he says the CFL thing that gets everyone stirred up, but there's nothing wrong with what he said. It was strong. Yeah. It was an interesting way to say. He could have just said, oh, he needs to look at, he needs to understand what's going on in the secondary better. Instead, he, put a little color to it, and it was good. And then, he's done the most Super Bowls, tied with Jack Buck, if I'm not mistaken, of anybody, because he's been doing the Super Bowl. He had been doing the Super Bowl for, 17, 18 years, and then he had the one on the TV. So he's done games. So he could have, to me, look, they did try an audible and get Peyton Manning during the Romo negotiations. But if they came up 0-2 on both those, if Boomer had gone in there, I think they'd been fine.
Yeah. It seems like a waste to have him do studio. I mean, that's what he wants to do. I assume he's obviously scaled it back a little. He used to do Monday Night Football. He used to do, TV, radio, this, that. Yeah. He does a radio show at 6 a.m. Monday through Friday here in New York, but he can easily be a lead analyst for a network, I thought, after watching that game. And then what's the deal now, Romo? Well, before we get into Romo, what he's going to do this week, do you find it interesting that, we've been told by networks, and I'm not blaming anyone. This is not to point blame because there's no one to blame, but networks have made a big deal about their protocols for their broadcasters. And it seems like every show has had COVID issues. I mean, the Fox college football pregame had them, the Fox NFL studio had them, CBS studio had them. I don't know, if the broadcasters are not taking it seriously or what's going on, but it's amazing how many people in sports media on television have been affected by this.
Yeah. Well, a couple of things there.
Saying given that they make a point about their protocols.
Yeah. I mean, CBS has been, from what I understand, the most probably stringent of all of them. No, they've all been stringent, and I don't want that to come across the wrong way. Like, they've all done, they've all put safety first, from talking to a lot of people involved. But we've seen in the country, I mean, I just think these are like a smaller, group. So again, I can't speak for everybody. I know a lot of people are taking it very seriously, but then are you going to have people who maybe aren't going to go and do every protocol and might go and meet somebody to eat when, these networks have told people to show up in the city and stay in your hotel room? I've talked to people, it's not been an enjoyable for like everybody else. It's not no hardship for the broadcasters, more so than anybody else, but it hasn't been an enjoyable season because you can't see anybody. So I don't know if you can blame anybody. I mean, I've made a point.
I just find it interesting that every single show has taken extensive protocols from what they say. And then every show has had issues.
I guess I would say, though, it's just like a microcosm of society, what's going on. And if you're getting together that often, that you're bound to have a problem, especially with protocols. I mean, you might not have been quarantined, but I mean, I know people, family.
I was. My brother had it, yeah.
So if you were on a studio show, you would have been you've been off for a couple weeks, So I don't know. I think it's like unavoidable, even no matter how. If you're traveling around, especially the NFL people are, you're going to have issues.
And so what's the status of Tony Romo for this Sunday's playoff game? They're talking now he's going to do it from home. What is it a matter of him just getting tested negative? Is there a certain date that he's done with quarantine? What are we waiting for here to find out if Tony's going to be at the game or doing it from home?
So, number one, when we're talking right now, no decision has been made. Mm-hmm. By the time maybe some people are listening to us, I think they'll announce where he'll be. From my understanding, the story that came out on Tuesday, I do believe most likely he'll be at home or in a studio in Dallas. He'll do it remotely. I guess there's an outside chance he could show up. It's not that far, Dallas to New Orleans, but I don't think that is likely at this point. And I guess the other option is, you know, depending on the situation, you know, if, you know, they had to have a replacement. But from this point, at this point, I would say most likely he'd be in a studio or at home doing the game.
Mm-hmm. Before we move on from this, since we mentioned Nance, you broke the story that he wants Romo money. Where do we stand with that? Is there contract talks going on? Do we know when we may find out if, you know, Nance renews, moves on? What's sort of the status with that?
Yeah, his contract's not up till the summer. I don't think anything's really changed as of yet. You know, it's one of those things where he has said he wants to do the Masters till he's, I don't know, like 1,000 years old. I think he's, you know, he said forever. I don't know. He did an interview. So, CBS has the Masters, unless he brought it with him someplace. I don't think that's, you know, right now the only place to do the Masters is CBS. You know, they do have Ian Eagle, whose contract's also up. And so, you know, they have someone who could do basketball and football. I know you're high on Harlan as well. You know, it's a little bit, it's a different situation than Romo's situation. You know, Nance has been the face of it, of CBS, but, you know, I think he could probably get a nice raise. I don't think, I mean, I think I could see his case, I could understand his thought process. I just also understand, like, the negotiations and just how Romo's thing just worked out. And even when you think about it, like, you know, we talked about Urban Meyer earlier, and like there are reports that he might get $12 million from Jacksonville, right? That's a big number. He's going to coach the number one, you know, choice in the draft, and Trevor Lawrence in Jacksonville, and Tony Romo makes $17.5 million a year. He makes $5.5 million more than Urban Meyer would make in that scenario.
Tony, right time, right place. You know, it's funny. You said in your last answer, you mentioned that Ian Eagle's contract is coming up. And in my head, I said to myself, oh, ask Marshan about, you know, he'd be a perfect fit at ESPN, Monday Night Football, all these other, he could do every single sport, college football. And then, you know, you go back to the Rinaldi thing where he left because, you know, ESPN wasn't going to pony up the cash. Is the ESPN situation at a place where, like, they wouldn't even entertain like an Ian Eagle because he'd probably be looking for, you know, good money if he was going to take on some major roles? Like, is that where we're at with ESPN, or could you see them, you know, at least still being players for someone like Ian, who is as versatile as it gets when it comes to sports?
Yeah. I mean, yeah, Ian Eagle would be perfect for them. I think they have money when they want to have money.
Right.
You know, so if
it's funny, I say that I say that about another company too, but go ahead.
Which one's that?
I'm not going to mention it.
Oh, no, I think I know which one you mean.
Yeah.
Is it Iconic?
It is, actually.
Is it Iconic? Yeah, it is. That's what I mean. It is Iconic. Yeah. It's Iconic for years and years.
Yeah.
Anyway, so I think if ESPN wanted to go after an Ian Eagle, you know, they could, but I don't know if they will, but they could.
The NFL did a game on a Saturday, week 16, where you could only watch it on Amazon Prime and Twitch. Was that basically to say to the NFL, like, look, you have all these packages coming up in terms of, you know, contracts, look at what we can do. Like, how close are we to where something can only be on Amazon Prime when it comes to the NFL? Please don't say close.
Well, I think Thursday night is really your big question. Like, nobody really wants Thursday night.
Which is amazing.
Yeah, I don't think so. I mean, I know you said it's amazing. I know you said that.
Well,
I think
just because from a network standpoint, if you have Thursday night football, you're going to win the night when it comes to ratings. Now, how much you have to pay for the contract is obviously
But Fox is paying $565 million. I remember that contract was done, and I was told by executives from other networks that it's like, you can't make money off of that. And so I think Fox, by virtue of not really wanting that now, it shows that. So yeah. if you're going to get that type of money, who are you going to get it from?
I said this.
Amazon has more money than God. So
I said this on this podcast to someone, and I don't remember who, but I think Bleacher would be a great option. Turner/Bleacher. Turner has the money. Bleacher Report, like Thursday Night Football. If I'm them, I would go after it. But that's just
that does make some sense. I mean, I was on a conference call with Jeff Zucker a while back. He didn't sound very
into it.
Now, he might be leaving, but he didn't sound bullish on them adding NFL at those prices.
Now this whole I don't even know what to call it, but these networks, these NFL networks now, you know, wanting you to think that it's so amazing that they're putting games on Nickelodeon and Freeform and I don't know what they're doing, having concerts before all is this all like a look at us NFL, look what we can do, give us the next TV contract? Like what is, or am I reading that wrong?
No, it's a combination. I think number one, I mean, the NFL loves to be on every network that you have, and how do you keep growing? And I think there is a want to build up that younger audience that doesn't necessarily watch full games. It watches clips on Snap and Insta. I'm trying to be cool calling them like that.
Well, here's Twitter. Here's the thing. I'm going to stop you before you get into like TikTok, and then we'll get recorded.
The young person
whose life, and I know them because I have them in my family, whose life revolves around TikTok and, as you said, Insta and Snap, they don't give a shit if the game is on Nickelodeon. I mean, that's not
going. No, but that's it. But they're going lower. They're going younger. So look, but to answer your question, yeah, fine. But they're still trying to get younger kids. You get younger, you know, right. Those are probably like, you know, teens or tweens. I'm just doing like every hip thing, even though tweens is probably like from 40 years ago. But anyways, the thing I would say is that, yeah, they're trying to get younger. So it's a combination, though. It's not for you, Jimmy. It's for
I know, people. Of course.
Right. You know, you're watching with your kid who's
right, but younger. What I'm saying is younger people don't watch TV. So you can put on Freeform and Nickelodeon and all these other channels, but the younger person doesn't watch those channels.
I think you're right and you're wrong. I think the young kid, I would say this. I think, yes, you're right. That's where we're going. Especially in the entertainment, like they're not watching these shows. It's all on demand. But I think the tail's a little bit longer than people think. Like everyone has everything dying before,
NFL is not dying.
I'm talking about the TV aspect of it. Like you're saying, nobody's watching Freeform and all that. There are certain shows that maybe they watch them like off of like the Freeform app. I'm sure they have advertisements for this. And then mom or dad on this NFL Sunday, he brings their kid in front of the TV. Let's watch the football game, but we'll watch it on Freeform. Mm-hmm. I mean, look, they're not going to do 10 million people, but if they do 500 to a million,
I don't have it. You know, no,
500,000 to a million. That's a good number.
There's no problem with them doing it, and they should do it. And God bless them. It's not that big of a deal. I mean, they want you to think like, oh my God, we're on Nickelodeon, we're on Freeform. Look what we're doing. It's so revolutionary. No,
you sound
it's not.
Like you love Russo. I know you said, but I don't know. I look. They did send out a press release. I don't. Did they make it like it's like they're?
Have you watched the games with the promos?
But yeah,
nonstop, nonstop.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean. Yeah. I guess, but they're trying to get the word out there. So I don't necessarily, I mean, I'm not a big, like that kind of promotion, I think kind of makes sense because you want people to know that it's there. I mean, I got on ESPN I'm watching the Orange Bowl and every 5 seconds, they got the little NFL draft music and they're telling me that the national championship's on. I think if I'm watching the Orange Bowl on January 2nd, I'm not saying you don't have to promote it every once in a while, but every 10 minutes we got a little, you know, I think somebody's about to get drafted and just unmute.
Two guys, we talked about Rinaldi, two other guys who are now done with ESPN. Just wondering if you have any thoughts, ideas about their next venture, Mike Golic and Dan Le Batard.
Le Batard, obviously, is going to do something digitally. I think he's already, there's talk if does he have something. I don't think Spotify is going to happen. I don't think that one's going to happen with Bill Simmons. I do think Sirius, I know they're fans of his, can that work? And maybe you do a local show in Miami as well. and you kind of try to recreate what you had. Look, he needs a big number to you know, he's supporting. There's a lot of people involved. They have a podcast network that you could make money off of. But again, like I said, I think that the issue is probably is that it's a big group, and so there's a lot of salaries to pay. And so when you don't have a big conglomerate around you, now I think Dan could be very successful because I think what he's built for is good for where the world is. Yep. Just not, it's not a fit with the radio. I know like maybe you and some others have kind of said like, how could they get rid of his show did not work on ESPN radio. I mean, like I said, you know, I've listened to the show. I get the show. It's just not a national radio show. I don't get it.
No.
Why?
Cause you just don't. If you got it, you'd understand that there's nothing wrong with it being an ESPN. It's not an ESPN radio show.
That makes no sense. You don't get it because people don't listen in other markets because Jimmy Traina has all day to listen to the show.
People listen outside of Miami. You don't think people listen outside?
Really? What affiliates was he on? Did he have a mic? Was he on in New York?
Nobody's on in New York.
Was he on in L.A.? Yeah, they are. Greenberg's on in New York.
And not one person in New York listens. Not one.
Greenberg's ratings were actually okay. His first book back.
What's okay?
The point being is it's a type of show. No, I'm right, number one. Number two is that it's a type of show that you have to listen to consistently. And right. In a digital world. I agree with that.
In a digital world
where I can make a choice, right? I can listen to his show.
I agree.
Doesn't work on terrestrial radio.
It works from this standpoint. This is what I mean. It works from this standpoint. He does have a big loyal audience. So I'm just saying I would think there'd be a little more respect for that. That's all I'm saying. Instead of just going with cookie cutter vanilla people who don't say anything and, you know.
Look, the ESPN has to figure out radio and how invested they are. They seem to be a little confused of what they want to do with radio. I think they should be more invested in it, you know, in terms of the product they put out there, because I don't think they realize, at least to me, they don't value how much it means to the brand and people's association with radio. So that's a fair point. I think Dan, at one point, yeah, you could make the argument, this is good, this is different. But like, I've written this. The edgy person does not really work at ESPN.
I agree.
Just swore on your podcast.
I agree.
Edgy person can't really swear on, maybe on their podcast, but they can't swear on ESPN. They have to toe the line. They can't really say exactly what they want to say. And it's owned by Disney. This is like, that's the way. All right. So Golic, you know, I would suspect he'll do some sort of podcast. I don't know what he's going to do. I thought he was pretty good on, you know, games. Could he do something with games? You know, Notre Dame would be, you know,
yeah, like, why aren't they bringing him back to do college football next year?
It's a good question. I mean, I don't know the answer, so I don't really necessarily want to guess, but it's, you know, they're cutting back on how much they're spending. So, you know, he was making a lot of money. So I don't know if they're said like, hey, take this amount and you can do college football. You know, that would make some sense, but there's a part of me that can understand that this guy has been a huge part of ESPN, you know, one of the front people, and now you're kind of diminishing them, so you kind of have to rip the Band-Aid off. I don't think that's like, it's not maybe kind, not humane perhaps in some regards. Although they treat him very well over the years and he's been classy in his exit. But I don't know. Is he just going to hang around, you know, as your fourth or fifth college analyst on games? I don't know if that really makes full sense.
Right. A last one. Did you enjoy SportsCenter running a fake Adam Schefter story as much as I did, or am I just very immature?
You're very mature. Because I actually feel bad for the person who actually did that. You don't feel bad?
Do I feel bad that someone saw a Twitter account that said Tua? What did it say? It said like @Tua something.
It was bad. You're right.
Here's what I'm gonna say. Here's why I don't feel bad. I don't feel bad from this point. It happens to everyone. It's not that big of a deal. The person shouldn't be in trouble. The person shouldn't be fired.
Trouble?
They shouldn't be in trouble. I said they shouldn't be.
But that's why I feel bad, because they most likely are.
Because then that person's bosses are jerks, because it's not the listen.
They might not be. So before we call everyone, I don't know exactly I don't know who the person is or what happened to him. However, I do feel bad for them because it's just a sinking feeling.
right. So now, I'm a monster.
The question is, yeah, you're a terrible person.
I love anytime any reporter gets duped by a fake story. I love it. Love it.
Why?
Can't get enough.
But that's different, though.
Here's why I like it. But here's why I like it. I don't think Schefter did it. I didn't follow closely. I like when the reporter, the actual reporter, gets outraged. Like, there was a famous one.
I agree.
There was a famous one where, like, John Heyman was like, some lowlife scumbag. Like, okay, it's a fake Twitter account. Like, can we relax? Like, it's sports and it's not important. Nobody cares.
Well, two things. Number one, if it's your name and that you're built on credibility, it's harmful. Number one, which I can understand. That said, I agree with you. At the end of the day, I think their proper reaction would be like, it's an honor to have someone doing a fake Twitter.
It's happened so many times. It's, you know, it's part of the gig at this point.
Yes, but no, here's the thing. There's a difference, though, between one of us in the media on Twitter retweeting a fake Twitter account, ESPN, reporting their own guy's fake report. I mean, I agree. Although I feel bad for the person because, unlike you, I have a beating heart. that's number one. But is it funny, you know, to put my, you know, feet in your shoes for a second? Yeah, I mean, the fact that ESPN got duped by a fake account for one of their own guys.
I'll say this so I don't come off as just a complete dick. This one maybe not as funny because you have like Chan Gailey and his family like thinks he's been fired or something like that. And that's not, but like if it's a trade, the fake trades are the best because no one's life is affected by that. So at least, you know,
it is. I mean, look,
or like so-and-so hired this team as their manager. Like those are the good ones.
And here's the thing. I don't expect the funny thing about the media and, you know, especially in sports media, like we're no different than anybody else. Like we're kind of like, we're media. Like we're like, no, we're just human beings. You know, we happen to do this for a living. The one thing I will say though, as a media person, it like you're Ken Rosenthal or John Heyman or Joel Sherman or whomever, you're an insider passing, whoever, you know, that's your credibility. And so, I try to break stories, you know, I'm like neurotic about trying to be right. And so, you know, you don't want someone putting out something that's not, so I guess I agree. You need to react the right way. You have to take yourself out of it for a second, take a deep breath, but it could be frustrating if people, believe it. And I can only imagine for Adam Schefter, that had to be incredibly, incredibly frustrating because that was really bad.
Well, no, you just go on Twitter and say, it's not me. Look at the account. There's no blue check mark. The name isn't my name. And, you know, move on.
Yeah, then
it's
you're
really
a jerk
not-
for, yeah, I know. But then if you're Schefter, then you're a jerk for throwing your teammate under the bus.
No, well, no, you got to address it if they get it. You're not throwing a colleague under the bus. You're clarifying the truth.
Well, they had to put a press release out that said this was wrong. And Adam Schefter had nothing to do with
it. You're laughing. You think I'm the dick, but you're laughing. It's on YouTube. Hey. You're laughing. So don't act like you don't like it. Last question for you. And anyone who's not.
I like the laugh behind the audio.
Anyone who's not from New York can tune out. But for our old school WFAN Mike Francesa people, I'm going to ask you one last question. Huh. We just started the new year. Will Mike Francesa have any kind of sports media job in 2021? A prediction, please, from Andrew Marchand, who has covered him better than anyone.
Good question. Any job? Can you define job for me? Like, will he do a show on FAN?
Will he do a show anywhere on a regular basis? On a, you know, like once a week, once a month?
Yeah, I would say history would tell me that he'll come back and do some sort of something. Like maybe once a week. That would be, again, how you define that. That seems to have been, I believe in kind of looking at people's patterns, and that usually can tell you something. Right. Now, he definitely was sick of it, but, you know, could he have something where he goes on, where he wants to get something off his chest every once in a while, where it's at his behest? I could see that happening. So if I have to give a thumbs up or thumbs down, I'll say thumbs up. They'll do something.
Gotcha. All right. Well, I appreciate that. And I appreciate you coming on, and happy new year. And we'll have you on, I'm sure, soon. And let's hope for more fake stories out there that people run with.
But, you know, Jimmy Traina, I mean, you could do some things with that. Jimmy Traina is reporting.
Yeah, then I would go on there and be like, hi, guys, it's not me. That's all.
You'd be the happiest. You'd be so happy.
I would be. Oh, absolutely. Honestly, I'll take any publicity, especially if they could do it. Like if they say I said it on the podcast, that would be the way to do it. All right,
man.
Andrew, take it easy. Bye.
All right, bye.
MTV's official Challenge podcast is back for another season. And guess what? So are we. Just in case you forgot, I'm Tori Deal. I'm a 6-time finalist and a Challenge champion.
And I'm Anissa Ferreira, and I've been gracing your screens for the last 2 decades. I am a veteran challenger and Challenge All-Star.
And speaking of All-Stars, All-Stars 4 is finally here.
I'm going to be honest. I literally thought this day was never going to come.
Well, the Challenge gods have answered our prayers, and we're going to be right here along with you fans covering every episode on the podcast.
And this season takes it to a whole new level. Old school legends, modern power players, redemption seekers, and ex-lovers are all competing in Cape Town, South Africa for the prize of $300,000.
Anyone can win, relationships matter, and only one all-star will claim the title of Challenge Champion.
Listen to MTV's official Challenge podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
If you love sports and true crime, then there's a new podcast from executive producer Dan Patrick and hosted by me, Jay Harris, that you won't want to miss. Playing Dirty Sports Scandals. Each week, I'm squeezing the juiciest details from some of the biggest sports scandals ever. I'm talking Marcus Dixon, Olympic gymnastics, Cain Velasquez, salacious Super Bowl-level scandals. Join me on the dark side of sports by listening to Playing Dirty Sports Scandals on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
What's up, everybody? This is Stephen A. Smith. When I'm not at my day job, First Take, you can find me in my studio hosting the Stephen A. Smith Show podcast. Tune in every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, at the very least, as I bring you all new episodes that feature the biggest headlines in the world of sports, pop culture, business, and politics. You'll hear my unfiltered opinions on those nauseating Cowboy fans, the chaos in Washington, D.C., and trending topics on social media, as well as my straight shooter interviews with top celebrities and game changers. And I occasionally give out love advice. Yes, it's true. If you want to know my true feelings about something, I'll give it to you straight. So listen to the Stephen A. Smith Show podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcast.
All right, joining me now, one of the executive producers of the upcoming HBO documentary, Two Parts on Tiger Woods, simply titled Tiger, and a longtime veteran sports reporter you're all familiar with, Armin Katayan. Armin, how's it going?
It's going pretty good.
It's good. You got to be excited with this doc. You know, in this COVID era, you know, sports were back, but we still yearn for content. We saw with The Last Dance. This reminded me of that a little bit. So you got two Sundays here of Tiger. It's got to be exciting for your book to now become this HBO docuseries.
Oh, it's thrilling. I mean, you know, Jeff and I, you know, being executive producers, we spent a couple of years on this project with, you know, the Alex Gibney Group and Matt Heineman and Matt Hamachek were the directors. And it was a real education in a lot of ways to go from one kind of storytelling, whether it's in television and things I've done in the past to books, to now this really high level documentary group. So it's been great. Yeah, I'm excited. I've seen it. I'm thrilled by it. I think it's intimate. It's revealing. It's humanizing in a lot of ways. As you know, Tiger's a very complicated person, and it's in the big picture, it's a complicated story. And I think the directors did a remarkable job in the choices that they made in the storytelling, because they could have gone 1,000 different directions. And I think in the end, in these two parts, you come away with a real understanding of not just the father-son story, but fame and fortune, the price you have to pay for genius. And I think, you know, Jimmy, it's a really interesting look, and you've seen it, about society and culture, not just race, but in media as well.
Yeah. I'm going to ask some broad stuff so people listening can get a feel for it. And then we'll get into specific spoilers, and I can give people a chance to tune out if they don't want to have anything ruined. And it's funny you mentioned that, because I feel like, you know, I did this with The Last Dance, and I did this watching Tiger, that both parts, you know, it's maybe it's because what I do for a living, I write every day and I cover the lighter side of sports for Sports Illustrated, but I can't help but watch it. And all throughout in my head, imagine if Twitter was around for this. Imagine if Twitter was, I mean, it, you know, I came away from it. And I wrote this in my column on Wednesday on SI.com. If people want to check it out, I'm not a Tiger guy. Most people are. I never got into Tiger. So I want people to know that perspective, because my review might be a little skewed from that same point. For instance, when that doc was over, I felt like for me, there was no one likable in that documentary, except for maybe his one friend who he ended up cutting out of his life. The father is not likable. The mother is not likable. Elin is likable, but comes off as pretty ignorant. Rachel, you could tell, no comment. It did feel, is that a bad take by me that I came away from it with that feeling?
No, as I said, he's a complicated guy, and you have to look at the doc, I think, in the beginning, in the prism through Earl and Tiger. And Earl's a, if Tiger is complicated, you can multiply that times two with Earl and all the history, the baggage, so to speak, the racially, culturally, socially, that Earl brought to his son. And then you add in the fact that he was a national television star at the age of 2.5.
Right.
Well, and what that does to a person at that age, I think what this is it's a remarkable autopsy of what it means to be who is Tiger Woods and what's the price of genius. And that's always been to me, when Jeff and I were starting the book, those were the two questions that drove us. And I think in the doc, certainly it's a foundation of what the doc is about. And when you see fame, and you mentioned Twitter, but there's some moments in there when, after he's hit the fire hydrant and his life falls apart, when he goes off that cliff, there's some very cringeworthy movements in there when you're looking at what people were saying on The View, late night talk show hosts, Howard Stern,
right,
being on the cover of the New York Post for 21 straight days, which was more than 9/11.
Right.
The rise and the fall was so precipitous.
Mm-hmm.
I think unlike any other athlete in history.
Right.
And then when you look at where he crawled out of, that makes for pretty compelling, you know, viewing by my perspective. Now, whether they're likable or not, that's personal. You know, some of these people I had very good relationships with. Others were not part of the book, and the directors did a great job in getting them in the chair, Rachel being one of them.
Yeah. I mean, the psychological part, I mean, I kept thinking, you know, HBO could do one hell of a crossover here with getting Dr. Melfi on the show to interview, you know, just to do the psychological aspect of Tiger's dad getting busted for cheating. And then Tiger obviously had his issues. And when I bring up the Twitter, this is what I meant, sort of, you know, early on in the doc, there's old footage of Earl where he says, you know, God picked him to mature this man and turn him into Gandhi and turn him. If that's in the Twitter era, Earl's going to get ripped to shreds for doing that to a kid.
That's from the Haskins dinner when Tiger was the collegiate player of the year. That has been like, what would you describe it as? Kind of the Holy Grail, in terms of no one has ever seen that footage. And I know that Matt Heineman and Matt Hamacek spent a tremendous amount of time being able to acquire that footage. And there's a reason it opens the doc, and there's a reason it's sort of the, it's like Earl from the grave speaking. And, you know, Gary Smith had it in his article for SI, the famous Chosen One bonus piece that he did. Right. But Gary was in the room, but no one's ever heard it from Earl's mouth. And that's like, as I said, talking from the grave. And that's so powerful because it really sets the tone for what's to come.
Right.
And I don't know how anybody could have lived up to, I mean, obviously those kinds of expectations.
Right.
But when you think about Tiger in so many ways, he obviously changed the game of golf, physically, racially, culturally, socially, and everything else. And in many ways, he lived up to what his father had predicted. But I go back to the point I made before is, but at what price to him personally?
Right.
And we all got to watch him and were awed by what he did. But I think what the doc does, and it's different, Jimmy, than you can do in a book.
Yep. I thought one of them,
video versus the written word, when you see it and you can hear it from those that were around him, it's just a different kind of story. And I think in many ways, it's a more powerful one.
I thought one of the most powerful parts of the entire doc, and I don't know if this is a known story or if this is new from the doc in the book. It was new to me, and I'm going to give I'm not going to be able to resist spoilers. So if you don't want spoilers, I understand you hitting the stop button, but we got to get into it. Was the letter that Tiger wrote to the girlfriend breaking up with her because his parents didn't want him to date her. You know, that's the stuff you see. And how do you not feel for Tiger in that situation?
That was one of the pivotal moments of his life, I think. Yeah. He was in love with Dina Gravel, his first, you know, we've all had first true loves. We know what that's like. And, you know, Tiger was at Stanford. He almost went to UNLV because Dina was there in Vegas at the time. But that wasn't part of the grand plan for Tita and Earl,
knowing
that Tiger was going to turn pro. And they were concerned about everything from Dina getting pregnant to Tiger's focus being turned away from golf. Right. And I had talked to Dina about it. We knew the letter existed, but we didn't know she kept it. And for her to read it on camera, and then you juxtapose that with the footage that you see in that sequence of Tiger just kind of unleashed. He's dancing, that scene on the floor where he's playing the air sax.
Yep, yep.
I mean, I hadn't seen that footage. And I called Matt Hamachek, one of the directors, right after I saw one of the cuts. And I'm like, are you kidding me? How in the world? He goes out, Dina had it. And she had kept everything.
I thought she was very,
that's one of the most. That's Tiger as a child or as a teenager, which we never got to see him. We always saw him as the killer and that killer instinct on the golf course. And that's what I think makes the doc so fascinating is there are those moments where you're just stopped in your tracks.
Yeah. I thought that was by far the most compelling part of the first part of the doc. I thought she was extremely compelling. The letter was powerful. I wanted to ask you this at the top and we got into it. Let me go back and turn. What is your personal relationship with Tiger Woods like?
I mean, I don't have a personal relationship with Tiger.
And the other question I have is, and this is a big spoiler, but it's not the end of the world. He doesn't come into this doc sort of on camera until a few minutes are left. Was that new footage that this documentary did, or was that something from somewhere else? I was a little confused by that. You couldn't get him to sit down for this.
Oh, no, no. I know that both the directors, both Matt Hamachek and Matt Heineman went, as we did with the book. I mean, they reached out to Tiger's people, and Tiger's people, as they have the absolute right to do, you know, declined to participate.
See, I thought he could have done so much positive for himself if he participated in this.
But Tiger's not going to participate in anything that Tiger can't completely control.
Right.
And if you look at The Last Dance, I mean, if there was any criticisms of The Last Dance, it was that Michael Jordan had just such a hold on it editorially. Yeah. In this case, and honestly, at the end of our book, and I think at the end of the doc, Jeff and I said to each other, we had spent so much time in Tiger's life for 3 years, immersed in his world for that long. I really don't know, having read everything he had ever written, had been involved in 350 transcripts of press conferences, what he could have told us outside of what everything we had ever written, because I don't think he was going to go any deeper than he's already gone in the past.
Well, that was the thing. When it was over for me, I also felt like I learned a lot of things in the doc that I didn't know, but I also felt like I still have no clue who Tiger Woods is. I don't know this person at all. And I don't know if that's because he's socially awkward. You know, I feel like the picture's been painted, not just in the doc, but ever since he won the Masters, you know, he's now like this devoted father and this is his life now. But I you know, for someone who's the great, you know, one of the greatest, like I feel like I know LeBron. I feel like we know Tom Brady. I feel like we don't know Tiger Woods. Now, again, I'm not a golf guy. I'm not a Tiger guy. So that's why I keep saying it, because I don't want people to think That's my perspective.
He's almost impossible to get to know. Yeah. He gives you glimpses of who he is, but even then you're not sure how that's being colored and how it's being presented image-wise. I mean, you think about that period of time when he was making $100 million a year outside of the game, and he had every, you know, gold-plated company in the world, corporation in the world that wanted him to be part of their brand. There was so much risk for him. I think that's one of the reasons he loved going to Las Vegas, because he could basically go, he was in a cocoon there. He could go from a private jet to a private limo to a private entrance to a private floor to a private room and do whatever he wanted with whoever he wanted. And no one would know the better, you know, at the mansion, which was behind the MGM Grand.
Even Vegas came off poorly in this documentary. It was like, this was the start of Tiger's downfall. The first time he went to Vegas.
Yeah. Well, you know, when you have Barkley and Jordan showing you around, it's a pretty good, you know, ambassadors for fun. Yeah. And don't forget, he was single at that time.
Right.
You know, when they showed him around, and, you know, one of the things they, and he went to them and said, he goes, you know, what do I say to these girls? And Jordan, you know, to his ever loving credit, goes, you tell them you're Tiger Woods.
Right.
And, in the end, after he was married, Vegas became, you know, a place where he could have a double life. And I think that's, you know, one of the things we didn't do, and certainly one of the things that Matt, the two Matts, as we call them, didn't do, you know, we don't editorialize, you know, they're laying it out factually. So the viewer at home can watch it and go, okay, I understand where he was at that period of his life. And the one thing that I think you can't do is try to put yourself in Tiger Woods' shoes. Mm-hmm. It's impossible. I mean, you can say, I have some idea what it's like to be that famous, but you really have no idea what it's like.
Yeah.
And I think that's where, in the end, you know, there's a word like, you know, like retribution, or, you know, the rise and the fall and the return, and he's a different person in the end. And if you get the feeling from the doc, that's not there. And that was purposeful, is to not make that editorial, to take that editorial stance, like somehow the world is a better place because Tiger crawled out of that hole. I think what comes across is Tiger's human, like all of us.
Right.
His humanity was a million times larger than anything that we've experienced. And I think in understanding what he was going through, I mean, there's a couple moments there where you see him looking around going, essentially, holy, you know what? I can't believe what I'm experiencing here. So look, these docs are choices. You know, it's like when you tell stories and I tell stories, you make choices on what goes in and what comes out. In knowing how many people had been interviewed, and the fact that it took 2 years, and seeing the different cuts that I saw, I think these guys did. From Alex to the two Matts, to Jenna Millman, to Trevor Davidowski, to all the people, Sam Pollard, that were all involved, Jeff and I adding our 2 cents when asked, and sometimes when we weren't asked. It's just a remarkable achievement on from my perspective.
Yeah, and again, I went into it thinking, are they really going to cover the cheating, the Thanksgiving, and all that stuff? You guys didn't sugarcoat anything. I mean, this was, like I wrote today, I could see Tiger and his family canceling HBO after this. I'm curious about one thing, and then I want to just get into a couple of specifics.
Yeah.
Does this documentary on HBO 2-part series get made if he doesn't win the Masters in 2019?
Like, I think that's a really good question. That's an ending that you can't even script.
Right.
You know, you win the tour championship. That's one thing. But when you come back to the Masters and the way he won it, which was just classic Tiger, the collapse of 3 and 4 golfers on the last from 12 on, you can't script that stuff. So, you know, I don't know. I don't know. I know that the book was the rights to the book were taken rather quickly. I do know, and it's funny that when we were right up until the end, when we were writing the hardcover version, it's January 2018, and we don't have an ending because we're just not sure what's going to happen. If you think of go back Jimmy, to May of 17 and Memorial Day weekend and what we all witnessed with that scene on the side of the road in Florida. And he thinks he's in California and he's messed up beyond belief. For him to crawl out of that hole, I went to San Diego to the Farmers Open and saw him there, and he was healthy. And it was a different Tiger. I saw somebody that was more human and more engaged and more just more personal with people. And I came back and we wrote the last probably, I don't know, 1,000 words, 2,000 words of the book. And that if you look at that, it's hopeful. There's hope there that he was poised to show the next generation of fans and tour pros what a living legend looks like. And he does that in September at the Tour Championship, but nobody, one for the ages, if you listen to Jim Nance, on the 18th green at Augusta, that scene, and it's almost perfectly bookended with what we saw in 97 with our own Tiger. And then, now with Charlie coming off that green, it's you can't make it up kind of stuff.
Right.
And that's where I think the, the beauty and the power in the doc is that there is an ending and it is uplifting. Mm-hmm. And it's not as we know from a lot of child stars. Sometimes those endings, you mentioned Todd Marinovich, other people have in the past, these kinds of endings are often tragic. And I think in Tiger's case, there is a triumph that you really can't even imagine.
Yeah. Almost. Yeah, because if he doesn't have that, it sort of ends with, the arrest and then basically him not playing well for months before the Masters. I mean,
at the Tour Championship, he wins there. That's something, but that's nothing compared to winning the Masters.
Yeah.
MTV's official Challenge podcast is back for another season.
And guess what? So are we.
Just in case you forgot, I'm Tori Deal. I'm a 6-time finalist and a Challenge champion.
And I'm Anissa Ferrer, and I've been gracing your screens for the last 2 decades. I am a veteran challenger and Challenge All-Star.
And speaking of All-Stars, All-Stars 4 is finally here.
I'm going to be honest. I literally thought this day was never going to come.
Well, the Challenge gods have answered our prayers, and we're going to be right here along with you fans covering every episode on the podcast.
And this season takes it to a whole new level. Old school legends, modern power players, redemption seekers, and ex-lovers are all competing in Cape Town, South Africa for the prize of $300,000.
Anyone can win, relationships matter, and only one all-star will claim the title of Challenge Champion.
Listen to MTV's official Challenge podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
If you love sports and true crime, then there's a new podcast from executive producer Dan Patrick and hosted by me, Jay Harris, that you won't want to miss. Playing Dirty Sports Scandals. Each week, I'm squeezing the juiciest details from some of the biggest sports scandals ever. I'm talking Marcus Dixon, Olympic gymnastics, Cain Velasquez, salacious Super Bowl-level scandals. Join me on the dark side of sports by listening to Playing Dirty Sports Scandals on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
What's up, everybody? This is Stephen A. Smith. When I'm not at my day job, First Take, you can find me in my studio hosting the Stephen A. Smith Show podcast. Tune in every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, at the very least, as I bring you all new episodes that feature the biggest headlines in the world of sports, pop culture, business, and politics. You'll hear my unfiltered opinions on those nauseating Cowboy fans, the chaos in Washington, D.C., and trending topics on social media, as well as my straight shooter interviews with top celebrities and game changers. And I occasionally give out love advice. Yes, it's true. If you want to know my true feelings about something, I'll give it to you straight. So listen to the Stephen A. Smith Show podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcast.
Now, this is going to be a really dumb question. I'm going to rely on you to help me out as someone who's not a huge golf guy. I mentioned the list of people who I thought, came across unlikable or badly. To me, in watching that, and I don't remember it from the time, I guess that's a bad job by Manship. No one came across worse or seemed more unlikable to me in that documentary than Billy Payne. I would have become the biggest Tiger Woods. Now, listen, Tiger cheating and having all these women, you know, that's his sort of personal business. And I can tell you just from being in this business, that is probably like a 4 on the scale of 1 to 10 out of athlete stories I've heard over the years. Yeah. I would have had so much respect for Tiger if he would have said, I'm never playing in this tournament again, based on what I mean, Brian Gumbel, I thought, summed it up perfectly. It was completely disgusting what Billy Payne did.
Well, for those who don't know, Billy Payne was the chairman of the Masters at the time when Tiger came back in 2010. And I was at CBS News at the time, and Sean McManus actually asked me, my boss, asked me to go down there and cover it. So I was there during that press conference, and I did 10 or 12 stories for CBS News during that week. And I was shocked that Billy Payne would use that moment in that podium to say what he did. I thought it was out of line. I thought it was, it wasn't that. My mother used to say there's a time and place for everything. Right. That was neither the time nor the place for him to condemn Tiger Woods personally. And to delve into his personal life the way he did.
And how he did it, too.
Yeah. And I think that it was so self-righteous.
Yes,
you know?
That's the word. Yes.
That feeling of self-righteousness, that who is Billy Payne? And this is now, I think there's no better commentator that they could have found for that moment than Bryant.
Yeah.
And I think he knocks it out of the park in terms of how it affected him. Mm-hmm. And that's as powerful a black voice as there is in our business. And so, I mean, I'll leave it at that. But I think you're right. It was one of those cringeworthy moments when you were there. Mm-hmm. But a lot of this stuff, when you go back and you see it in the doc, you know, that cascade of, as I said before, of that when you know, the comeback or the when the fall hits and everybody just piles on. And you mentioned social media now, it would have been 100 times worse now. But even back then, that's really the beginning of, you've got TMZ, you've got the tabloids.
You know, I remember it so well, because in 2010 at that time, I was writing a daily column for SI called Hot Clicks. And it was sort of covering the lighter side of sports. And I remember this like it was yesterday, because this was huge. The traffic to everything about this was huge. And I remember, and I was so glad you guys showed it in the document. I think one of the best videos of all time that's ever been made on YouTube, I've posted this 100 times over the years, is the Taiwanese animation of the Thanksgiving night. And you guys showed a clip from it. And that was sort of the beginning. That 2010 was the beginning of sort of the internet and Twitter and everything going into this other level of absurdity. And this, you know, the Tiger thing really, that Thanksgiving night was sort of the kickoff of, I think.
Oh, for sure. No question. Yeah. And when you cross over from the sports world into the mainstream media, when you're leading, you know, the CBS Evening News and World News Tonight and NBC News night after night after night. And then when you try to, as Tiger's people did, somehow control this forest fire that was burning, it's just impossible at that point in time.
Yeah.
And, you know, and then when one after another of all the women that he had relationships with, you know, that whole thing picks up steam. You're basically, you know, you're just going to get run over at that point in time. And he did.
Yeah. You mentioned earlier, much earlier at the top, Howard Stern getting, I'm a huge Howard fan, and he did the Tiger Woods.
Oh yeah.
Mistress Beauty pageant, where we had them all. I mean, it was out of control there for a few months.
I watched that is one of the things that I watched when we were, you know, reporting for the book, and there's some audio from that in the documentary. And it was, again, you know, it's just going to kind of like, how low can you go in terms of the Tiger fest that was going on?
Right.
And for those women to get on there, and I think it was $10,000. That was the price, whoever could, you know, being judged by Howard and others.
Yeah.
But that was the media, you know,
right.
That was, and I say the media because, you know, we all get lumped wrongly, I think, into the same basket sometimes. And for Howard, it was entertainment, but that's what happens is when an athlete of Tiger's level, and you can go back to the days of, I mean, obviously OJ, and you look at the Marv Albert situation, and then Tiger comes along. Other people's misery becomes other people's entertainment.
Right.
And it becomes almost a channel of its own. And I think that's one of the things in the doc you see is like, it's, there's that moment in time when you just can't, you can't avoid everybody taking a piece of Tiger and turning it into gold for themselves.
Yeah. Yeah. It was the perfect storm. And like you said, once you cross over out of the sports world, which Tiger had done for years before that, in the doc, you see him on Oprah and all this other stuff. That's a storm you just can't weather. I want to talk about something you just said about the media and we all get lumped in. One of the moments for me in the doc that made me sort of almost angry in a way, tell me if I'm wrong on this. There was the gentleman who was the family friend, and now I forgot his name, unfortunately. I can't remember his name. Who talked about, this was before Tiger, Thanksgiving, Elin, and the golf club and all that.
Yeah.
He talks about how, and I agree with this, that there is a lot of, in the media, fans build you up, knock you down. Or yes, we want to see the heroes get taken down.
Yes.
I believe that's true in most cases. That was not true with the media.
Oh,
I have never seen an athlete get treated by the media in a more over the top way than Tiger Woods. There was nobody in the media rooting for Tiger Woods to fail from what I saw. Am I wrong? No,
you're absolutely right.
Okay.
He was almost untouchable.
That comment was absurd when that guy was trying to say that this whole thing was sort of like part of the build you up, take you down. No, it wasn't. No one was trying to take down Tiger Woods.
I think what happens is, Jimmy, is that we do build you up. And then that moment in time, when you cross over your personal life, and I've always believed in athletes or coaches or anybody I was ever covering, their personal life was their personal life.
Right.
But when that spills over into the public, when you do something as an athlete, when you make a mistake that puts you on the police blotter or puts you in the public eye, now that's a different story, because that is a decision that you made that has repercussions to it. Tiger hitting that fire hydrant on Thanksgiving in 2009, that was the trigger, the bomb that went off that then spilled over into everything else. And I agree with you. He was untouchable. And there's a reason for that. I think the golf media in general is more genteel. It's more gentlemanly. It's less inclined to be controversial. And on the other side of that is Tiger was very protective of his image, and Mark Steinberg, his agent, and Glenn Greenspan for the longest time, who was his head of his PR. They were piranhas when it came to people that would take a chunk out of you, or there would be repercussions in terms of access to Tiger.
Right.
If you said something or did something that they didn't like.
Yeah. When I've said I'm not a Tiger guy, a big reason I wasn't a Tiger guy was because I couldn't take the way the media treated him. It was so over the top. And I remember it so well because this became one of these big things. There's no footage of it. I've looked for the footage so many times over the years. He did that press conference, which that is a fascinating part of the documentary. After he gets caught cheating on Elin and all the women come out, he does a press conference, which that alone is, I didn't realize there was blowback from the Tiger camp. I guess there was some infighting about whether they were
shooting. Oh, there was no question.
There was a
lot of infighting.
There was a Golf Channel analyst. I think his name was Charlie Reimer. Is that who literally went on TV after that press conference and cried because he felt so bad for Tiger for getting busted. The media coverage of Tiger is a whole other documentary you could probably do. It was so
well.
Absurd.
It's just this, you know. Look, he's as I said, when you look at the kind of the atmospherics, and I've sat in those media tents where Tiger comes in. It's very scripted. There's somebody that's right next to him who points and says, okay, Doug Ferguson from the AP, you know, Doug, you've got the first question. And it's not like a college basketball press conference, certainly not an NFL press conference. But those, as time has gone on, access has become more restricted and it has become more of a controlled event. I've never seen anything quite as controlled as a golf press conference. And the Karen Krauses of the world and the Alan Shipnucks of the world, when they wanted to ask a tough question, they had to have the courage to stand up in one of those media tents and ask a tough question. And that's hard to do. A lot of people don't want to do that. Right. Or they have to try to get Tiger in a moment away from that. And that's almost impossible to do.
Yeah. Another, I thought, very interesting part of the doc that I remember at the time happening and forgot about till it was in the doc. And you want to talk about the media and Tiger. One aspect of the media, like you said, we sort of all get lumped in. Well, the media entity that was not sort of in the Tiger fawning section was the National Enquirer.
Yeah,
that guy was quite a character. That guy will trend on Twitter when the documentary airs. But you know, you said earlier we can't put ourselves in Tiger's shoes, and I couldn't agree more with that. I think when you hit that level of fame, that kind of money for us to analyze Tiger is absurd. But it did. I was blown away by the brazenness and the stupidity of, you know, you got caught by the Enquirer.
Yeah,
they let you off the hook. They killed the story because you did the Men's Fitness, and then you still were so brazen, you got caught by them again.
Yeah.
And they had the pictures of Rachel. You could tell. I mean, I was surprised Tiger wasn't more careful, at least with all this. Rachel, you could tell, even says something about, like, Tiger's team got me a floor or a suite in the whole. So yeah, his whole team knew about this. I mean, he wasn't as discreet as you would think.
There was an inner circle of Tiger's people, Team Tiger, that were complicit in this and were involved in bringing the girls, flying the girls to wherever Tiger would want them to be. You know, one of the things that is not in the doc, but I think is sort of felt in the doc is that sex addiction, like alcohol or gambling or drugs, is a form of pain relief. And I spent far more time with sex addiction experts in reporting the book than my wife probably would like me to have spent. You know, I go down one time and I have like a 2-hour interview and she goes, how long were you there?
Yeah.
2 hours. Why were you there for 2 hours? I was like, well, you know, I had a lot to talk about. But what you learn is that it is a form of pain relief. And at a certain point in time, it wasn't about the sex for Tiger. It was about pain relief. And I think that's where you get sloppy and you know, things start to spill over. And as you're, and you see it in the doc, and you feel it in the doc, is you almost take it as a car headed off a cliff and the brakes are off and you just don't know what you're going to hit and when you're going to spill over. But as that need for pain relief is accelerating and his sex life gets, and there's some allusions to that in the doc, gets more and more complicated. You know, sooner or later, with the National Enquirer tracking him, which is not something you want in your life, that that bomb is going to go off.
And they ran the story about him and Rachel. You could tell, and Elon bought their story, and then they still blew it. That's what's, you know. Was it difficult to get Rachel, you could tell, to sit down for this? Because I think she opens up when she's on camera, her sit down, by saying like she's never talked about this. Was it?
No, she hasn't. I mean, I can tell you this, that Jeff and I both tried for the book to get Rachel to cooperate with us. And she declined as her right to participate in the book. But when the book was finished and she read it in the hardcover, she was pleased with how we portrayed her and her relationship with Tiger, which opened the door when Alex Gibney at first with Jeff and I in New York met with Rachel to really just kind of connect Alex with Rachel. And she wanted to listen to how the doc was going to be put together, what her participation would look like. And she ultimately agreed. And I think that's a credit to not only Alex, but to Jenna Millman, one of the producers, and certainly Matt Hamacek, and really Jeff Benedict, my co-author, who spent far more time with Rachel than I did. And, you know, I think she's an extraordinary part of the doc. I really do. To get her, and as you saw, the cliffhanger in part one is like the best. I mean, when I saw it for the first time, I called Hamacek and I was like, oh my God, that is so good. How can you not come back and watch you know, part two after this. And so I think Rachel, you're absolutely right. She wanted to tell her story. It's never been told the way she tells it. She's always been at the mercy of others, portrayed as a certain kind of person. And I think she's very honest and very open about not only that part of it, but about her relationship with Tiger and what led to that Thanksgiving night that was just an extraordinary evening on so many different levels. That was the beginning of the end of Tiger's marriage.
Yeah, that night is... There's nothing to describe in it. No. Is there anyone, obviously besides Tiger, is there anyone you wanted to get that you couldn't get to sit down and talk on camera?
Well, it really wasn't so much me. It was, you know, the directors were looking for everybody. I mean, I would have loved to have had, we have Rocco Mediate in there. Yeah. Nick Faldo is in there. I would have loved to have had somebody current, a Ricky Fowler or a Justin Thomas, to kind of bring Tiger current with where we are with his relationship with those guys. I think some of the guys that, I mean, Phil would have been great. I think to have that in, but you know what? I kind of know, I mean, look, there's an embarrassment of riches to a certain degree. Now I know there were several people that were interviewed, that just, they couldn't, you know, you've got to make choices. Where do you get on the off ramp? Where do you get off? Yeah. How long do you stay in a certain place before you move in another direction? So I think Rachel and Dina Parr, his first true love, Amber Loria, who was a person that was very close to Tiger. She's one of the nieces of Mark and Alicia O'Meara. I think those are, she was a terrific person to have. Joe Groman, who was the assistant pro and now the pro at the Navy course where Tiger grew up. Mm-hmm. Who really understood Earl and Tiger and his relationship with both of them. Look, it's not 10 hours in The Last Dance. It's three hours, I think, in 15.
No, it's a very easy, very easy watch. I'll let you go. I summed it up this way. I said, if you're into the golf aspect, part one is great because it covers him as the prodigy, covers him building up his career, and then obviously his just complete and utter domination. And then part two, you get the philandering Tiger with, of course, the nice ending that we all know about. Is that a fair summation of the...
Yeah, it's the rise, the fall, and the return. Yeah. I mean, that's what it is. And I think they, you know, when you look at it like that, it's kind of hard to beat it.
Yeah, I would expect the National Enquirer guy and Rachel, you could tell, to trend on Twitter a week from Sunday when part two airs.
Yeah, that's for sure.
All right, Armin, thanks a lot for coming on. And again, it's Tiger, HBO Max this Sunday and next Sunday, the 10th and the 17th, 9 p.m. Eastern. And I'm sure a lot of people will be watching.
I hope so. Thanks, Jimmy.
Thanks. Appreciate it. Okay. That wraps up this week's edition of the SI Media Podcast. Thank you for listening. My thanks to Andrew Marchand and Armin Katayan for joining the show. As I said at the top, we ended 2020 with a two-part SI Media Podcast roundtable with Peter Schrager from Good Morning Football and Andrew Perloff from The Dan Patrick Show. If you did not listen, check those episodes out. We did a year in review of sports media and pop culture, and I've gotten a ton of great feedback on it. People seem to enjoy the roundtable and sort of the banter with those two guys. So go into the archives, check those out, and subscribe. Please subscribe to the SI Media Podcast. And we'll see you next week right here. Take care. Be safe.
MTV's official Challenge Podcast is back for another season.
And so are we.
I'm Tori Deal.
And I'm Anissa Ferreira.
The wait is over, guys. All Stars 4 is finally here.
And this season takes it to a whole new level. Old school legends, modern power players, and ex-lovers are all competing in Cape Town, South Africa for the prize of $300,000.
And we're going to be right here along with you fans, covering every episode on the podcast.
Listen to MTV's official Challenge Podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
If you love sports and true crime, then there's a new podcast from executive producer Dan Patrick and hosted by me, Jay Harris, that you won't want to miss. Playing Dirty Sports Scandals. Each week, I'm squeezing the juiciest details from some of the biggest sports scandals ever. I'm talking Marcus Dixon, Olympic gymnastics,
Cain Velasquez, salacious Super Bowl-level scandals. Join me on the dark side of sports by listening to Playing Dirty Sports Scandals on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
What's up, everybody? This is Stephen A. Smith, host of the Stephen A. Smith Show podcast. Tune in every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday at the very least as I bring you all new episodes that feature the biggest headlines in the world of sports, pop culture, business, and I answer your phone calls and respond to your tweets. You'll hear my unfiltered opinions and straight-shooter interviews with top celebrities and game changers, all that and more. So listen to the Stephen A. Smith Show podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.